Reactor online. Sensors online. Weapons online. All systems nominal.
Hello, everybody. Carrie here, and today we will be talking about my experience at Southern Assault 2023 in this episode. I tried to get all the players' names I played against, but to be fair, by game four, I was pretty out of it. That being said, though, I want to talk about my experience at the tournament itself, as well as talking a bit about sportsmanship and conduct at an event. Before we begin, we should take a look at my list that I ran for the event. In this list, I had a Dasher P at skill 4. Actually, everything's at skill 4 unless I say otherwise. A Dasher P, a Hunchback C, a Warhammer 2C 11, Mad Cat W, Mad Cat Mark II 2, a Sphinx 3, two heavy infantry units, two Marauder battle armor units, and then we get into the not skill 4, a field medic at skill 5, two heavy hover APCs at skill 6, and two skimmers at skill 7. This comes out to a total, at least as of the tournament, at 375 points. I don't think anything's changed point-wise since then, but obviously, sometime in the future, this will probably not be valid, so best just to bring that out right now. So let's look at round one, which was, once again, the fight scenario, which is basically a stand-up fight. The first game I played was against Justin Freeman, who was running a Clan Hell's Horses army. The list he ran was a Dasher H at skill 4, Phoenix Hawk 2C6 at skill 4, a Thor HH at skill 4, a Warhammer 2C8 at skill 4, a Tomahawk 2 Prime at skill 4, an Ost Scout OTT-12R at skill 7, a Koshi M at skill 6, a Mastodon B at skill 4, and a Jingao JN-G7LR at skill 4. Now, like I said before, the game was a stand-up fight, and of course, this made it a pretty straightforward match. And since we were both skill 4, and my mechs had to do a lot of heavy lifting, we ended up finding ourselves trading units throughout the game, and I did end up winning, and ended up with an advantage overall as I was able to push early into the center of the table and into his side of the table by using the heavy hover APCs to drop the infantry in the middle and using the Marauder battle armor with the two skimmers, because as weird as it will sound, a squad of Marauder battle armor can ride a skimmer. But I used those to drop almost into his deployment zone with the Marauder battle armor. That tied him up long enough for me to get everything sort of pushed into place. And for the most part, the game took place in a 12-inch by 12-inch square on my right side of the table on his side. So basically that, for him, what was the left corner was pretty much where the whole game played out. I want to say the Koshi had went to go flank, of all things, and it ended up running back over to try to help out. But overall, it was a good game. And I was able to pull off a very, very slight win at 15 points. Round two was against Brian McGuire. Brian was running a FedCom list, and he was awesome to play against. It would seem that I didn't take any pictures of Brian's list. But it was, if I recall correctly, mostly mech-based again, and thankfully didn't include any artillery, which I have to say was the bane of my existence in two different games. In strategic points, there are three objectives laid out across the table. Along the center line from left to right, and you're attempting to maintain control of the objectives. And that's the scenario we were playing. In the end, I went, ended up winning against him in what was almost a complete blowout of 30 points due to the amount of units I had to put on objectives. So far, this had put me at 45 points, just strictly for battle points, not counting anything else. And like I said, he was a pleasure to play against. It was a really fun game. Had a really good time with him. And I hope that if I go back to Southern Assault next year, which I want to, but we'll talk about that later. But if I go back, I hope I get to play with him again. It was, excuse me, it was very fun. So, round three, I had against Brian Kirby. Brian brought with him an army from the Raven Alliance, and it was pretty much built for this kind of scenario that we had, because it was the hold the line scenario, which is also at the same time a breakthrough scenario. It's really, really weird. Basically, you're trying to get as much of your army on your opponent's side of the table as you can, and keep your opponent from getting their army on your side of the table. And to be fair, playing a breakthrough scenario versus playing a, I forget the term here, a hold the line scenario are two completely different mindsets, two completely different strategies. And if I had to pick for worst possible, worst scenario to play at a tournament, hold the line is definitely one of the, well, I should say this kind of hold the line is definitely one of those. I have played a version where essentially the opponents rolled and determined who was the attacker, who was the defender. And based on that, you were scored based on how that worked out, depending on your role, as attacker or defender, not your die roll, but I guess the die roll has something to do with it. But what Brian brought to this list, like I said, it was built for this type of engagement. It's a white raven at skill 4, a black lantern sea at skill 4, a black hawk prime at skill 4, Shadowcat Eye at skill 4, Pouncer G, skill 4, two Onurus Attack VTOL Cs at skill 5, two Balok Strike VTOL Hybrids at skill 5, and two squads of Stormbird Battle Armor at skill 4. So, this round was rough, and when I say rough, I mean really rough. We were both trying to get to the other side and kill as much of the enemy as possible at the same time, and we both succeeded in doing both. I did end up finding the game to be very frustrating as the VTOLs kept zooming in, getting themselves into back shots, and Brian did set up better to take advantage of cover, leading to a battle where we both sort of rotated around the center of the board. In the end, though, I was able to eke out another win, this time bringing in another 20 points, and for round four, putting me in the top group after three rounds, barely. Now, mind you, I say this, but there's something we'll need to also talk about with the tournament format. And he, Brian was a, he's apparently a newer player. I'm glad he came out to the tournament. Had a really good time playing against him. The scenario is just an awkward one. But it's not as bad as the ball. You all remember the ball from last year, the stand next to the thing and hope you don't die. It's not as bad as that, but it's up there. Round four is where everything turned south for me. I played against another Raven Alliance army, this time commanded by Zach Oh, I'm gonna so mispronounce your name. I apologize. Zach Eusebio. Round four was a scenario called "Did I Hear You Say Supplies?" This one is the five objective type setup, where each player has an objective about 12 inches from their corner, 12 inches in from the side of the board, and then in the center, dead center on the map, is a objective token. Zach's army consisted of a Blood Asp C at skill 3, a Black Hawk F at skill 3, a Ryokan J at skill 3, a Shadow Hawk 2C, skill 3, a Dark Crow 4 at skill 3, Grasshopper GHR-5H at skill 3, a Goshawk 6 at skill 3, a Phantom H at skill 3, and a Dasher E at skill 4. This game was brutal in a way that I cannot describe, as it seemed that whenever I would make a move or do anything, I would end up losing a mech or a unit. In the end, my theory of superior raw dice, or essentially the law of large numbers versus the idea of lower skill pilots, ended up being my downfall. As before the game had even really gotten into a good endpoint, I was down to two mechs and two infantry stands. By this time, I was outnumbered so heavily, I think I had killed one unit, maybe two. But yeah, the game, I was outnumbered so heavily, and the game became, as I described to the judges, when I had to ask them what I needed to ask, a procedural ass kicking at that point, as I no longer had enough units to even put up a fight. In the end, the game cost me heavily and handed my opponent a major win, with me taking 0 points and my opponent gaining 35, relegating me to the middle of the field, a place I would find myself stuck in. And the reason for that is I pretty much said, look, I have no army to fight you with. I have no, that it's a throwing in the towel situation, but given the way things were at that moment, yeah, it's it was just, yeah, the game was, it was no longer, excuse me, it was no longer a game where there was any chance of me taking any of the win conditions, as it were. And at that point, instead of wasting his time and mine, I felt, yeah, might as well just kind of move on from that. So after game four, I am essentially deaf in one ear at this point. That's also another reason I sort of felt the need to basically just throw in the towel. I was deaf in one ear. I could barely talk. And my head felt like it was being split open. So after this, Sarah and I ended up retiring to our hotel after going out to a local restaurant. I think it was called The Farmhouse, where they have one of the greatest foods ever, fried chicken skins. And yes, that is all it is. It's an appetizer, and they give you a ton of it. Like, you could feed like five people with this thing. The food otherwise was pretty good, and that night before going to bed, I built the new Fortress exclusive mini, the Gawain, which, oh, excuse me, I have hiccups, which was part of our swag. Now, speaking of Fortress miniatures and games, I would like to let you know that they are sponsoring this episode. Well, they're our sponsor, and if you want to get their new exclusive mech or have any battle technique needs, I would highly recommend them. You can find them at fortressminiaturesandgames.com. Also, if you like the podcast and want to support what I do here, then I would encourage you to go to patreon.com and sign up as a patron at patreon.com/unicorncompany. So now, on to round five. After a good night's rest, well, not much rest, I went back into the tournament with what felt like a weight lifted off my shoulders, as well as barely a voice and the still the inability to hear out of my right ear. which, like I said, helped make that decision to withdraw from the field on round four. Because I couldn't even really hear my opponent by then. Now, round five was a scenario called Tactical Chaos. And for this scenario, I faced off against a great guy, Chris Mitchell. The way this scenario works is it is essentially King of the Hill, but surrounding it are eight small walls, which can go from line of sight blocking to partial cover at the end of each round. Chris brought a Draconis Combine army consisting of a Nodaki. I think I pronounced that properly. If I'm not, somebody let me know in the comments, because this will eventually end up on YouTube. Somebody let me know in the comments if I'm not pronouncing the mech's name right. Nodaki NDA-2KO at skill 4, a Nodaki NDA-2K at skill 4, an Urban Mech UM-AIV, an Aero 4 Urban Mech at skill 2, Shiro SH-2P at skill 4, Roku Rokubi RK-4X at skill 4, Rifleman 2C7 at skill 3, a Charger CGR-3KR at skill 4, J. Edgar Hover Light Hover Tank Tag Variant at skill 4, J. Edgar Light Hover Tank Flamer Variant at skill 4, and two squads of Inner Sphere Battle Armor Magnetic also at skill 4. Now, to be fair, what won me this game was raw numbers. The Irby would pelt me every round with an Aero 4 pretty reliably, but I was able to put more assets on the center of the table longer and even use some creative blocking to keep my opponent out for the better part of a round. Also, the skills weren't that big of a deal here, as the majority of the battle that mattered was fought almost exclusively at short range, where we would constantly beat on each other. I was able to take a win from this round with a total of 20 points, giving me a total by then of 85 going into round 6, which meant pure battle points wise, I may have still been floating in the top 50%, possibly by sheer luck, maybe in the top 25 in percent, that is. In my final round, I played against Eric Lowe, who was very fun to play against. Eric came with a Clan Jade Falcon Salama list, which was interesting to see as most everyone was running frontline units. Eric's army reflected this too in its makeup with a Goshawk at skill 6, a Phoenix Hawk PXH-1B Special at skill 5, a Locust C at skill 5, a Warhammer 2C3 at skill 5, a Marauder 2C8 at skill 5, an Anhur Transport at skill 5, Svantovit Infantry Fighting Vehicle at skill 5, a Maxim Heavy Hover Transport, Clan version, skill 5, a Zephyr Hover Tank, Royal, skill 5, a Huey Assault Tank at skill 4, two squads. Or 2 points of Clan Foot Rifle Ballistic Infantry, skill 5. Two ad hoc Clan Foot Infantry at skill 5, and a Clan Jump Point Flamer at skill 4. This scenario we had for round 6 is Extraction, though I prefer to think of it as Escape from LA. Or is it New York? The one where he rescues the president. The reason for this is that there are two objectives representing downed aircraft, and near these are tokens representing crew. You want to rescue the crew by being next to them for a turn and not shooting, and also want to hold the downed helos at the end of the turn, or end of the game, sorry. We both made a mad dash for the downed crew and pretty much wiped out most of each other's assets capable of safely getting them off the table. And then I had to start. I started to make progress too late in the game, as I did have an edge at that point and essentially went into, for lack of better words, rampage. Near the end of the game, trying to clear everything so I could just get a win by, if I kill everything, I can go grab the people and walk off the table with them. I think I should have gone with that at first and then brought in support units to pick up the crew, but I honestly didn't think of that. It was an awesome and epic game, and we ended up pulling out a perfect draw. I mean, like, purely perfect draw. Both of us pulled 12 points. Neither of us got any bonus points. It was interesting. So ultimately, after soft scores and everything else, I would place 56th. So near the... Yeah, out of 80, I mean, it's not great, but near the upper end of the lower 50% of the field. Overall, I had a good time. Round four was just rough with starting to lose my voice, my hearing, probably running low blood sugar by then. As far as the tournament overall, I feel like there could be a couple things that would make it better. The first of these, and like I said, I was going to kind of talk about scoring and all that when we got to it, but here it is. One of those things would be to have use win, loss, draw, and then use points to shuffle those out. So the way the system works, it is purely point based. It doesn't weight a win, a loss, or a draw. So the way it stands right now is, if you somehow do amazingly great through all six scenarios and just beat the snail snot out of your opponents, then you can win based, like, a lot of it heavily. I mean, it's what I did last year. I had games that went really well for me, and I was able to get really high point values out of it. But it doesn't weight your wins. So in theory, you could do okay for five games and have one game where you just crush your opponent, and then, you know, that'll get you a win on the board, or as far as the overall tournament, that could possibly happen. I feel like it should go by win, loss, draw, then by points. So, like, for example, at 80 something players, you start to get into the possibility of having two people who run 6-0. But if they run 6-0, then you look at their points, and that would give... So essentially, this is best general, because there are other soft scores. There's painting, there's a quiz, sportsmanship, army fluffiness, which is an interesting one. It's composition, but I don't... Composition is one of those weird things where it doesn't feel... I don't know how to put it. It might be something we have to talk about in another video or another podcast at some point, is weird tournament stuff. And it's not just Battletech. I mean, there's weird tournament stuff in every tournament I've ever played in. But yeah, so you could... Having, like, a win be 10, a loss be 0, and a draw be 5. And then on top of it, you have... So your positioning's based on that. And then it's based on your other points, like objective scored, bonus points, all that stuff. So you could end up having this system that will theoretically, possibly... I mean, stars would have to align for there to be a tie by the end of six games with points plus win-loss draw record and everything else. You know, there's, yeah, it's, I feel like there's room for improvement there. Because it can lead to some really interesting results. The other thing I think would be useful, and this is something that I've seen apparently used in Battletech, and it's not an official rule, which is funny because I had thought it was. And that is a modified initiative system where for each turn that you lose initiative after the first, you get a plus one to your initiative roll on the next turn, and it's cumulative. The whole point of this is to keep games from, because I've heard horror stories about games where initiative literally goes six turns straight for one player. Which, yes, it happens. But at the same time, or 7 or 8 turns, but you have a player that's constantly on the back foot the entire tournament, or the entire round, I should say. But if you have a system where it's after your first turn, you lose initiative. Every turn after that, it's a plus one modifier. So, first round, you both roll. One of you loses initiative. No modifier. Round after that, you both roll. Same person loses initiative again. On the next roll, they'll get a plus one to their roll. If they lose it again, they'll get a plus two and then a plus three. And I guess you could cap it at like a plus three or a plus four. Because by then, they should have hopefully won initiative by that point. Also, the reason for the first turn does not count against it is because it would make it where if you lose initiative after having it for four turns and they had a plus whatever, that first turn you lost initiative, you would get a plus one the next turn if you did it, if you counted that first round, you lose it. By not counting that first round, but starting after the second time you lose initiative, it sort of evens that out and makes it where initiative swings a little bit more. And it you don't end up with this weird static like 4 or 5 turns straight of somebody losing initiative, which is weird to see and weird to experience as well. I've been in both ends of that, and it's odd. So, especially in a tournament setting, where you're trying to put players on as even a footing as possible, I could see that being a thing. Now, I did mention there was something else I wanted to bring up, and that is the subject of sportsmanship, or I should say conduct at an event like this. Something that shook me was at the end of round three, while Brian and I were tallying up our points, two tables away from us, there was a player screaming at another player. And his words were, and this is to the best of my memory, "It doesn't fucking say that you have to be alive." And he was saying that in reference to scoring on the hold the line scenario. I can only assume this is in reference to the bonus of if all your units cross the center line. It doesn't say that they have to be alive. And as written, I would agree that to score that everything just has to have crossed, but not lived. But if you have a situation where you and your opponent don't agree on something at the end of the round, you shouldn't try to scream down the other person. And that's my opinion, but when you're standing there across from somebody else, screaming them down, you are essentially trying to intimidate them. And that behavior has no place at a gaming table, and it has no place at a tournament. I was surprised nothing happened from it. Because he was quite loud, and it caught the attention of all of the tables that were there. So at least in that surrounding area, the table directly next to us, they noticed it. The table behind him noticed it, and of course afterward he apparently went outside. I think he came down with a group. He was outside fuming over this afterward. He was very, very angry about it. Also, sort of on the same subject, sort of sportsmanship concerning my round four, there's been a great deal of discussion over the years. Battletech, Warhammer 40K, War Machine. I never played in a bolt action tournament. Okay, so those three, mainly. I think I've played something else competitively, but I can't remember it now. But there's been a great deal of discussion over the years whether it's ethical or fair to surrender a game in a competitive setting. Now, many people will bring up the social contract aspect of the game, and I am one of those who does believe that in a match, if you are so outclassed that you have no chance of winning the game at all at that point, the game is a predetermined solution by a certain point. There is nothing wrong if you have given it a very good effort, you've tried your best, and you just find yourself at such a disadvantage that you're essentially just moving around pieces to be killed off by your opponent. This is a war game after all, and in that spirit, there will be times when a good commander knows that they don't stand a chance on the field any longer. I do know I was rather curt with my surrender, and I do want to apologize to Zach for that. By the time I did, I was struggling to talk, struggling to hear him, and I just totally felt out of it, and I'm sure it made me seem kind of grumpy. So, with that, since today is Thanksgiving in the United States, I felt that it would be appropriate to present a unit that is proper for the holiday in our Mech Tech segment. Today, we'll be looking at the Turkina. The Turkina made its first appearance during the Battle of Tewkiid in the Turkina Keshik. Keshik? Keshik? That's a weird clan word anyway. Turkina Keshik of Clan Jade Falcon. This massive, imposing machine fills the role of the direwolf in Clan Jade Falcon units and began seeing full deployment during the refusal war between the Falcons and the Wolves, creating a rift in the Wolves that wouldn't heal until the 3150s. I apologize for the sniffling. The mech proved itself in that conflict after the Falcons defeat at the hands of the Comm Guards. With the Direwolf existing, though, one has to wonder why the Falcons felt the need to have a mech that did the same thing but separately. Now, to understand the genesis of the Turkina, one has to understand the Direwolf and their access, the Clan Jade Falcon's access to it. Or I should say, the lack of access. We won't be covering the Direwolf in depth, but some knowledge about the design is needed to understand why the Turkina exists. The Direwolf is a 100-ton monster of a mech. It primarily saw deployment during Operation Revival among the Wolves and Smoke Jaguars. The other clans who had it available to them at the time only had it available because of captured units from inter-clan trials. During Operation Revival, the success of the design was apparent to all who used it, including the Jade Falcons. With the limited access, the Falcons began to design their own massive assault mech and based it around their style of combat that they favored, which encourages maneuverability. Because of this, the Turkina was built to favor a level of maneuverability that isn't found in the Direwolf or many of its variants. The Falcons did attempt to keep the Turkina as exclusive to their clan as possible, but as fate would have it, through inter-clan trials, it was lost to other clans, and it would see service among other clans in the invasion corridor, as well as in the militaries that took part in Operation Serpent and Bulldog after the Smoke Jaguars were defeated. And because of this, the abjured Nova Cats were able to gain access to the design as well. So for a time, and I haven't checked availability in the Ill Clan era, but for a time, the Turkana became a mech that could possibly seen throughout the Inner Sphere, especially with the DCMS and the Nova Cats. The Turkina itself, though, is a machine that is very maneuverable and deadly for its weight. The mech is 95 tons, and its base chassis. Well, that's a weird typing error on my part. 95 tons. Oh, I know what I was going to say something here. I moved it. It's 95 tons and has a maximum speed of 54 kilometers an hour, made possible with its use of a powerful 285 rated extra light engine that houses 15 double heat sinks, giving it a good amount of cooling for its weight, along with a relatively decent speed. The mech's speed is supplemented, though, through the use of three jump jets that allow the Trakeena to leap up to 90 meters at a time. This added mobility gives the Trakeena an ability to reposition that is rare among assault mechs and would be a harbinger of the mobility found in later Jade Falcon machines. The mech itself is built on a standard chassis that makes up roughly 10% of the machine's weight and is clad in an impressive 18 tons of standard armor. The use of standard armor as well as standard structure obviously doesn't save any weight, but it also leaves the interior space of the chassis completely open for the most part, other than the engine, the jump jets, and your necessary things like shoulders, hips, leg stuff, and all that. But this leaves it with a lot of room to be able to shove big bulky systems into the mech, and it has a total of 42 tons of pod space available. This is 3 tons shy of half of the mech's half of the mech's total mass. So you can devote almost 50% of the mech's weight to weapons and equipment. The primary configuration of the Turkina is a mixed machine that is, in a way, it reflects aspects of a few different mechs. It has a pair of long-range missile launchers, 15 racks on each shoulder, which are sort of a callback to the Mad Cat. In its right arm, it carries a pair of extended-range particle projection cannons, which feels like it's taken from the Warhawk. The only weapons that feel unique on the configuration are a pair of LB5X autocannons in the left arm with 2 tons of case-protected ammunition, which give it the ability to either find open holes in the damage created by heavier weapons or to act in an anti-aircraft role, a much-needed role on the battlefield. The Alpha configuration of the Trakeena pushed the mech into a pure sniper role. The mech carries a pair of LRM-20 launchers, one in each of the mech's shoulders again, and it carries a single Gauss rifle in each arm. The configuration is highly effective in the role that it has, but also suffers from the fact that it's completely ammunition dependent. So unless the pilot decides to engage in the Inner Sphere tradition of melee combat, it has a limited lifespan on the battlefield. Bravo configuration of the Trakeena is more of a brawler than the previous configurations and leans heavily on laser weapons. In the right arm, it carries a pair of extended range large lasers, which give it the ability to strike enemies at very long ranges, followed up by two highly accurate large pulse lasers in the left arm, which also give it a slightly shorter range punch with much higher accuracy. The secondary weapons on this configuration include a mix of ER medium lasers, one in each side torso, and medium pulse lasers with one in the head, and one in the center torso. Also, these weapons are all linked to a targeting computer, which make them even more accurate, allowing the Bravo configuration of the Trakina to strike with terrifying precision. In its Charlie configuration, the Trakina leans even more into the brawler role, adding to that role the job of an urban infantry hunter. It keeps the two large pulse lasers in the right arm of the Bravo and throws the rest in the trash for a much more aggressive close-range loadout. This starts with a massive LB-20X autocannon in the left arm. This is backed up with a Streak SRM-6 launcher and a pair of machine guns in the right torso. It does mount a pair of medium pulse lasers in the left torso as highly accurate backup weapons. Showing lessons learned about anti-mech attacks by the Inner Sphere infantry, this configuration mounts an explosive anti-infantry pod and a flamer in each leg. This weapons loadout shows that the Falcons not only wanted to have a machine that could replace the Direwolf, but also that they learned key lessons from their initial time in the Inner Sphere. Now, the next two configurations are attempts to integrate newer technologies into the Jade Falcon Tumman. The first of these is the Delta configuration. This mech focuses on the advanced tactical missile system, carrying a pair of ATM-12 launchers in each arm. These launchers can fire one of three munitions. One gives it a very, very long-range reach, doing about the same damage as long-range missiles themselves. The next type is a medium-range missile that does roughly the same damage as short-range missiles. And finally, a short-range missile type is available that does 150% of the damage per missile that a short-range missile does, making them extremely deadly and effective at close ranges. With a total of 10 tons of ammunition, the ATM systems on board can easily make use of every munition type. These are backed up by two ER medium lasers in case anything weathers the storm of missiles located, and the lasers are located in the head and center torso. The last configuration we're looking at for Classic is the Hotel configuration. This is a configuration that features heavy lasers, or should I say a type of heavy laser. In this case, it's heavy medium lasers. It has one in the left arm and two in the right arm. Each of these lasers hits with the force of an inner sphere particle projection cannon. In each side torso, it carries an ultra autocannon 10, allowing it to put up a blistering fusillade of fire. These are all backed up with a pair of medium pulse lasers. Once again, one in the head and one in the center torso. The Hotel configuration, its accuracy is enhanced through the use of a targeting computer again. This increases the accuracy of all the weapons on the mech, and because heavy lasers suffer from a rule that makes it harder to hit with them at any range by plus one to your target number, the targeting computer helps to eliminate that little bit of I don't want to say problem. I can't remember the word, but it helps to eliminate that little bit of a hindrance against the weapon. Okay, so now let's look at the mech from the point of view that I'm more used to looking at mechs from now at this point, and that would be from Alpha Strike. Now, the base chassis for the Trakina in Alpha Strike, it's a battle mech, size 4, TMM1, movement of 6 jump. It has armor of 10 and structure of 5, and will always have the Omni special ability. The prime configuration comes in at 56 points and is a sniper. The mech puts out 5 at short range with a medium and long of 6 with no overheat. It has the added specials of case, FLAC 111, indirect fire 2, and LRM 222. So this is a good all-around yet hard-hitting assault mech that can handle a variety of roles and brings a few different tools to the table. Primarily anti-aircraft with FLAC, indirect fire 2. LRM 222 doesn't come into play in tournament settings, but more for casual play or campaigns. Indirect fire 2 lets you hide behind cover if need be, and someone spots and you can shoot them, which, well, you can try to shoot them. So overall, a pretty good mech for, for a 56-point assault mech. Alpha configuration is a 56-point missile boat and has identical base damage stats as the primary configuration. In fact, if you wanted to put two of almost the same Trakina on the table for Thanksgiving, you could use these two. Where they show a difference is in the special abilities, as this one, other than the Omni ability, comes with Case, Indirect Fire 2, and LRM 222, foregoing the FLAC ability of the Prime. Bravo configuration is one that is set up that, at least in Alpha Strike, is harder to kill than the previous two. It comes in at 58 points, and it is a juggernaut, and it lives up to the title. It does 7 damage at short and medium ranges, with 5 at long. It does have an overheat of 1, and it has the energy special ability, which makes it much harder to kill because if you roll a 2 for ammunition, well, you don't do anything. It just ignores it. Charlie configuration, we once again get more of a utility machine as a juggernaut at 54 points. For starters, it has damage values of 6 at short, 5 at medium, and 3 at long, with an overheat of 2. The mech's utility comes in with its special abilities of case, so it doesn't blow up easily. FLAC 110, so it can still do some anti-air work just without the long range. Probe and recon, making it a mix of an anti-aircraft platform if it needs to be, as well as the ability to find hidden units and scenarios. Delta is the first of what I would call the beat stick configurations. This one has a short of 12 with a medium 8 and a long of 4. It also has 2 overheat, meaning if it can close the short range, this configuration can put out a massive 14 damage. The Delta configuration doesn't have much utility as it only has case as its only special aside from Omni. And it is 64 points and does come classified as a juggernaut. I believe the Echo configuration, which is what we're looking at here, of the Turkina reaches the apex of the beat stick configurations. It is a juggernaut that comes in at a massive 64 points. These 64 points buy you an amazingly high 10 damage at short and medium range with a long of 3. The Echo does not have an overheat capability, but it really doesn't need it. It does, however, bring a lot of damage and a decent toolbox as it has case and it has the FLAC 322, making it one of the better anti-aircraft platforms in the game, oddly enough. So not only does it throw 10 attack dice or 10 pairs of attack dice, but it can also pretty reliably hit a helicopter or a VTOL. Or aero, well, useful against an aerospace fighter, not perfect. Hotel configuration is the budget version of Echo, coming in at 2 points less at 62 points. It is a juggernaut and is capable of similar damage with 9 at short and medium and 4 at long. And it also does not have an overheat value. It also lacks the utility of the Echo configuration, as it only has case in addition to the baseline Omni. The configuration is one that if you do need to shave a couple points off of a list, this is where you're going to be able to find those extra, like, 2 points. You're going to lose a damage, you're going to lose some utility, but you need those 2 points for a reason. You can get it here. Now, finally, we have the mic configuration. This is probably the most balanced configuration of the Trakina and is, in some ways, a budget Trakina. It comes in at 49 points and is given the role of sniper with the ability to hit with 4 damage at every range and an overheat of 1. It has specials of case, flak 111, and indirect fire 1, giving it some utility with balanced firepower. The Trakina, be it in Alpha Strike or in Classic Battletech, is a powerful machine capable of standing toe-to-toe with other clan assault mechs of a similar weight class, like the Direwolf and the Kodiak. It is also capable of outmaneuvering many of these machines with its jump jets, giving it an edge on the battlefield of the 31st and 32nd century. So, I do want to thank all of my patrons for making this episode possible, and would like to welcome our newest patrons, Haley Saint and Richard Johnson. If you'd like to join our Patreon and gain access to custom Alpha Strike cards for mechs that we have covered, giveaways, and anything else I might cook up, join us at patreon.com/unicorncompany. Also, I once again want to thank my sponsor, FortressMiniaturesAndGames.com. If you need anything for Battletech, I would highly advise checking them out. So that is it for today. I hope all of you have had a wonderful Thanksgiving, at least if you're in the States. If you're outside the States, yes, we're carving up turkeys today, and the president usually pardons one. It's weird. But yeah, so I hope everyone out there in the rest of the world has a wonderful day or has had a wonderful day. And to my American listeners, I hope that you are enjoying your Thanksgiving. Please be careful on the roads during the weekend and after the holiday. And if you're going to be out shopping on Black Friday, also be careful with that as well. Traffic can get pretty bad on that day. So until next time, this is Carrie. Signing off. I'm gonna find my meaning, I can make a change. I wanna play the game. You wanna sink or swim? I'm gonna go down swinging. Look deep within. Get lost in the field. Just need a win. I'm going off. I know it's time to make a change, and I can take the pain. You wanna sink or swim? I'm gonna go down swinging. Look deep within. Get lost in the field. Just need a win. I'm gonna find my meaning, I can make a change. I wanna play the game. Okay. Now, where did I leave that command key for the Balius? What the? Oh, shit. Oh. No. Cats can't drive mechs.